So what about this whole Donald Trump is Cyrus thing? What are we to make of that?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. We'll take your Jewish-related questions of all kinds today, Israel-related, Hebrew-related, anything that ties into Jewish studies, Judaism, Jewish people, Jewish background to the New Testament, 866-34-TRUTH. Phone lines are open. Want to catch up with things happening around the Jewish world, but we're going to focus in first on the Hebrew Scriptures and the whole question of this comparison with Donald Trump and King Cyrus. We want to start there, and we're going to open the Hebrew Scriptures in a moment, but we're going to read to you from what is called the Cyrus Cylinder. This was written 538-539 B.C., discovered in 1879. It's written in the language called Akkadian, which is the language of the Babylonians and the Assyrians. And these are the words of Cyrus himself. So what in the world does Donald Trump have to do with Cyrus? If you think I'm saying that Donald Trump is God's man and especially anointed and you can't argue with him, no, 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 no. If you think I'm saying Donald Trump is raised up as a messianic figure by God, especially anointed to save America. No, no, no. That's not what I believe. There's only one savior for America and the world, and his name is Jesus. Do I believe that in a unique way, God raised up Donald Trump? It could be for blessing. It could be for judgment. It could be for both. But do I believe in a unique way that God raised him up, and that there is a parallel with this in the Hebrew Bible? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. So in my new book, Evangelicals at the Crossroads, I have a whole chapter addressing this question, did God uniquely raise up Donald Trump? And trust me, I give all the arguments against it. I give the outrage quotes from Christian leaders and others saying, how can you possibly say that? Look at the man, and so on and so forth. And then I explain why I believe this to be the case. Now, again, we can differ over this perfectly fine. I'm not staking anything on this except I find it to be an interesting comparison and something worth considering. So the first thing is that even before Trump announced he was going to run for president, there were prophetic words about him being our next president or him being a future president. Now you say, look, there are prophetic words about everything. You know, there's prophecies about this city and this person and who knows what to make of it. Fair enough. There's flaky prophecy, there's real prophecy. Fair enough. But when you have a number of people unrelated to each other, different parts of America, different parts of the world, who all get this sense right before the elections, early in the primaries, that God is going to raise up Donald Trump and that he'll be our next president, and that there's a comparison between him and Cyrus in the Bible, that when it happens from a number of different people, it gets my attention. So in the book, I document some of these different prophetic words, including Lance Wallnau, who felt God showing him a comparison between Trump and Cyrus. He was one of a number that felt that way, that there was a comparison between Trump and Cyrus. You say, okay, I'm still not getting it. I'll explain in a moment. But what's significant was that Cyrus was a pagan king, an idol-worshipping king who did not know the Lord, yet the Lord raised him up to do good to Jerusalem and to Judah and to rebuild Jerusalem. So he did good for God's people, even though he himself didn't know the God of Israel. And Lance Wallnau actually read Isaiah 45 to Donald Trump, where God says, I'm calling you by name even though you don't know me. And Lance felt led by the Lord to look at Isaiah 45 and hear the Lord say Trump will be president 45. It's like we've had more than 45 presidents, well, more than 45 presidential terms. But if you're in office for two terms, it's just one president in office for two terms. But what does the book of Isaiah say about this? What are we to make of this? Remember also on the day of the elections that there were major polls that gave Trump a 1% chance of getting in. So the extreme unlikelihood of him getting in, the extreme unlikelihood of him beating Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and John Kasich and Scott Walker and Mike Huckabee and Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina and others that were part of this. I mean, 16 candidates, the unlikelihood of him beating them, and then the unlikelihood of him beating Hillary Clinton and the Clinton political establishment and so on, highly unlikely. But then you add in the prophecies on top of it, and the volatility of his presidency, I personally believe in a unique way God raised him up, but it could be for blessing, it could be for judgment, it could be for both, okay? So let's first look in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 44, beginning in verse 24. Isaiah 44, 24, beginning in Hebrew with the words, Kol mar Adonai goalecha v'yortzecha mibaten. So this is what the Lord said, your Redeemer who formed you in the womb, Anochi Adonai Oseh Kol, I'm the Lord who made everything. And then he goes on, who alone stretched out the heavens and unaided spread out the earth. So in the midst of idolatry in the ancient world, in Israel, the Jewish people in exile in Babylon, God saying, I alone am God, not the gods of the nations, not the gods of the others, only me. And then it goes on, Mefer Otot Badim, who annuls the omens of diviners and makes fools of the augurs, who turns sages back and makes nonsense of their knowledge. Mekim devar avdo, but confirms the word of my servant, Vatsat Malachav Yashlim, and fulfills the prediction of my messengers. It is I who say of Jerusalem, it shall be inhabited, and of the towns of Judah, they shall be rebuilt, and I'll restore the ruined places. All right? I, who said to the deep, be dry, I will dry up your floods. And now look at this. And who says of Cyrus, who says of Cyrus, Roi, you are my shepherd, and he shall fulfill all my purposes, and he shall save Jerusalem. She shall be rebuilt, and to the temple you shall be founded again. So he's going to say this of Cyrus, a Persian king. Then, chapter 45, verse 1. Komar Adonai Limshicho, the Choresh. Thus said the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed one, in Hebrew, his Mashiach, that later becomes the word for Messiah. Thus said the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed one, whose right hand he has grasped, treading down nations before him, ungirding the loins of kings, opening doors before him, and letting no gate stay shut. I will march before you, and level the hills that loom up. I will shatter doors of bronze and cut down iron bars. I will give you treasures concealed in the dark and secret hoards, so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by name. For the sake of my servant Jacob, Israel, my chosen one, I call you by name. I hail you by title, even though you have not known me. Right? V'lo yidatani in Hebrew, even though you have not known me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Beside me, there is no God. I engirded you, though you have not known me, so that they may know from east to west that there is none but me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. We'll stop there. So this extraordinary statement of one God alone in the midst of a monotheistic world, spoken against the background of the Babylonian captivity, all right, these prophecies of Isaiah, and raising up Cyrus, but God saying, I've called you by name. I'm titled you even though you don't know me. All right, now, let's listen to the words of Cyrus. Cyrus conquers Babylon basically without a fight. And the priests of these various temples were feeling neglected and their deities being neglected by the king of Babylon. And Cyrus basically, with the discontented people, is able to walk in without a fight. So listen to what Cyrus says. You ready for his words from the Cyrus Cylinder? I am Cyrus, king of the universe, the great king, the powerful king, king of Babylon, king of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four quarters of the world, son of Cambyses, the great king, king of the city of Anshan, which was in like southern Iran, grandson of Cyrus, the great king, king of the city of Anshan, descendant of Tespis, the great king of the city of Anshan. So he's saying, I've got the real pedigree here. The perpetual seat of kingship, whose reign Baal, which is Baal, but here meaning Marduk, and Nabu love, so these different gods, and with whose kingship to their joy they concern themselves. And then he says this, he's going to praise the chief god of the Babylonian pantheon. Marduk, the great lord, bestowed on me as my destiny the great magnanimity of one who loves Babylon, and I every day sought him out in awe. Marduk searched everywhere, and then he took a righteous king, his favorite, by the hand. He called out his name, Cyrus, king of Anshan. He pronounced his name to be king over the world. So Cyrus is saying, Marduk laid his hand on me. Marduk called me by name. Marduk took me by the hand. And Yahweh, the God of Israel, saying, I did it. I raised you up. I raised you up to bless Jerusalem and the Jewish people, even though you don't know me. Harry Truman, when he helped the United States cast a key vote to recognize the modern state of Israel in 1947, 1948, Truman said, I'm Cyrus. He got it. He understood his role, that here he was a Gentile, but called to bless Israel and the Jewish people. So it has gotten the attention of the people of Israel that it was Trump, with these Cyrus prophecies over him, who moves the embassy, the American embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. What do you know? How absolutely interesting. To me, there is a legitimate parallel, namely, God uniquely raising someone up. You could argue that every election, God is raising someone up, or in America, we vote and we get who we're voting for, and God lets us, you get what you want, kind of thing. But there seems to be unusual divine intervention, for better or for worse. Please hear me. Unusual divine intervention, could be for blessing, could be for judgment, could be for both, in the raising up of Donald Trump, but as a Cyrus-like figure doing good to help God's people while not even knowing the Lord. I pray that he will know the Lord, or if he does know him, that he'll know him more deeply. But obviously, in voting for Donald Trump, I didn't think I was voting for a born-again Christian man whose life reflected our values, yet I saw God using him to do good for God's people. That's happened. To me, the parallel is good. This is not a prophecy about Trump, but the parallel works.
God of light, hear our cry.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to the Line of Fire on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, the voice of Paul Wilbur singing. Man, I love that song, Shouts of Joy. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. And if you differ with me on given points, please call. We welcome differences. We welcome even hostile differences. If you are convinced I'm crazy, a fool, a heretic, whatever, and you want to give me a piece of your mind, that's why we pay the money to do live talk radio. That's why we do that. So you have the opportunity to call and share your heart with me and with all of our listeners and viewers. We'll give you the platform for you to differ. All right, can't give you a whole hour to do it, but you say what you need to say, and I'll respond honestly. How's that? So won't it be great to say goodbye to the chaos of 2020, to the confusion of 2020, to the pain of 2020, to the suffering, to the hardship, to all the negatives of 2020? Why not set your sights on being with me in Israel next year? Yeah, we have moved our Israel trip. It was originally scheduled for May. We moved it to October. But we weren't comfortable with that. We felt too uncertain. So we moved it to March, the first 10 days or so of March 2021. So join us. It is the trip of a lifetime. We call it Holy Fire in the Holy Land because there's something special by day and by night. It's not a political trip. It's a biblical trip. It's one of these things where the Bible becomes alive and biblical truth becomes alive. It's really supernatural the way it happens. To be honest with you, it's more than just I can explain it humanly to you. Something happens very wonderful and special on these trips. But we've got an amazing tour guide that knows stuff inside and out, every detail, that's with you every step of the way. We have our team with you every step of the way. And then during the day, I will also do teaching at key sites. Now, there's a tour guide is doing the key stuff, but at different sites, maybe like Mount Carmel, we've done it every year, where Elijah called on fire from heaven as we look out over Har-Megiddo, over Armageddon. I'll do a teaching there. I've done that every year. Or baptisms at the River Jordan. When I was first asked to do that the first trip some years ago, it's like, that is hokey. I'm not okay. If people want it, I'll do it. That has been a sacred time, a beautiful sacred time. But then every night, I'm doing something with the tour group. We may do a Q&A together after dinner. We may have a time of worship. I may preach. We may do a radio show, go to a meeting where I minister. So every night, if you want to, we're doing something, and you're getting to hang out together with me, and I'm getting to hang out with you. So go to AskDrBrown.org. It's right on the homepage, AskDrBrown.org. Find out more about the trip. It is really the trip of a lifetime. And get your deposits in, because we have some empty seats now, but they're going to fill quickly, I expect. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Before we get over into some major Jewish news, things happening in the world, and a bit regarding the tragic blast in Lebanon, the terrible explosions there, let's grab some calls. And we'll start with Joseph in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi there, Dr. Brown. How are you today?
Doing very well, thanks.
So this time my question is for Zechariah chapter 5.
Yep.
There is a being known as wickedness.
Mm-hmm.
A female entity.
Yep.
That is put in a basket and is taken to Sinar. And they said an angel of the Lord tells Zechariah that a temple will be built for her. And there are two women with wings like a stork that carry her away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a twofold question for it.
Yeah.
The first question is, this being known as wickedness in the basket, could this symbolize Babylon? Or I kind of lean towards this one, Diana or Artemis from the Ephesians.
Right.
And then the second fold portion of the question is, the two women with the stork wings, now that these are two beings that are mentioned, only reference I know of in the Bible of these two winged female beings, does it open the possibility that there could be female angels?
Got it. So to answer the second question first, this would be the only reference in this particular way. We know that angels don't procreate, correct? That we know.
Mm-hmm.
Any angels that are named are always masculine, be it Michael, be it Gabriel, or in later tradition, Raphael or Metatron, they're all male. The Hebrew word for angel or messenger only occurs in masculine form, malach. You don't have it in a female form occurring in the Hebrew Bible with reference to anyone. A keruv or a seraph, these other angelic beings are all masculine, but we know that angels don't procreate, meaning if there is such a thing as male and female, it's different than what we would be used to. So the question would be, why would you have male-female angels if there's no procreation? If now, obviously, in eternity, we're not going to continue to procreate, but we were made male and female on this earth for differentiation and procreation. But in eternity, some of those aspects will not come into play anymore. So I would not build a female angel doctrine based on this myself. I put a question mark next to it because it's symbolic vision. And I personally can't give you any dogmatic view of how to interpret it. As for the mystery and wickedness and so on, and can that be equated with Babylon, or you mention other goddesses, Diana, Artemis, this opens up a really complex question, namely, who or what is Babylon in the Bible? And we know the physical city of Babylon and the Babylonian Empire that existed 2,500 plus years ago. But Babylon, Mystery Babylon in the Book of Revelation, who or what is that? It's a massively debated topic. It's one that I continue to not be dogmatic about myself. But to me, this could be an early picture of the same thing, meaning this personification of wickedness seen as female, that Babylon becomes more of an idea and a system and a spiritual force than a physical place or a specific country. That could well be how Babylon is to be understood, in which case this is kind of a precursor of it. And while I wouldn't see it specifically as representing Diana and Artemis, and again, I'm absolutely open to various interpretations of Zechariah 5, sir, because it is visionary and there's not a lot of context in terms of repetition of the vision to understand it or application of the vision. I would say that to me, Diana and Artemis are part of this larger female deity, demonic stronghold type of thing that can then be tied in with Babylon and the fertility rites and the sexual seduction and things like that. So in my view, and again, with no dogmatism at all, I would see the female god worship or the Asherah or others in the ancient world or Astarte as part and parcel of this larger potential spirit of Babylon, female deity, seductive, destructive. Beyond that, keep digging, sir, and I'm absolutely not dogmatic about any of this. The best modern commentary on Zechariah I know is Mark Boda. Mark's a friend of mine, top Old Testament evangelical scholar. It's, I don't know, 700-800 pages in depth on the book of Zechariah. So if you really want to dig, Mark Boda's commentary is terrific, B-O-D-A. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to Demopolis, Alabama. Frank, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Brown. I've waited a really long time to be able to speak to you. I get you on American Family Radio, and they're playing you on Sundays at this time of day.
Yeah, so it's a repeat broadcast, right? You can't call in live. Well, great to finally talk to you, Frank.
Well, it sure is. And I had three questions about a calendar that I got from the Friends of Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a donation to them, and they sent me a Jewish calendar for the year 2017.
Yep.
But anyway, I had three questions I couldn't resolve looking in the Bible for stuff.
Yep.
But one of my questions, the first question was where the Jewish calendar started. In other words, what the date would have been when that since. I did some subtraction and came up with 3760 B.C., but that wasn't what I wanted. What I wanted was what was the occasion in the Bible.
Right, so that is a matter of speculation, sir, starting there. In other words, that we have a calendrical year now, right? And it's,
yes.
You know, so we're in the 5770s, et cetera. And that cannot be traced all the way back in biblical history. The chronology of Archbishop Usher, and he put creation of, 4004 B.C. So you get that by doing what you're trying to do, which is counting backwards and going through the genealogies and you know, the years as best as possible. So you come up with 3760. But that's all us doing our best based on biblical data to figure out how far back this goes. Jewish tradition comes in later. In other words, we do not have definitive ancient tradition from the biblical world that things were being counted the way that we count them. That's not how, when you read inscriptions, it's in this year of this king or at this time, because you didn't have external years being counted that universally recognized. So when exactly Judaism came up with this idea of the clock started ticking 5,700 something years ago, That's much later. We don't know the origin of it. Okay, we'll come right back with your other questions and more.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you just tuned in on a Thursday, this is the day of the week we focus on Jewish-Israel-related subjects. So the calls we take are Jewish-Israel-related. Hey, just want to welcome a bunch of spammers on YouTube who are flooding our chat with anti-Israel propaganda. Call me. You got some great arguments. You think that there's truth to what anti-Semites are saying or anti-Zionists are saying? You can articulate it. You got the data. You got the info. Call me, please, by all means. When people just, you know, flood our site, they just get blocked because we don't allow anyone to take over with their agenda. But we love interaction. We love healthy interaction. We love debate, dialogue. Please, by all means. When I'm invited to give a lecture on a campus on a given controversial subject, my request is always that they find a suitable and adequate opponent to debate me. And if we can't do that, then we have live Q&A after the talk, because I want people to be able to raise their objections, and then I want to be able to respond to them. Okay, and by the way, everyone wants to remind me it's 5780. I know I kept saying 5770s. Yes, 5780 on the Jewish calendar. All right, so Frank, theoretically, 5780 goes back to creation, but again, that's just theoretical. That's not that Jews have been counting from there all through the centuries. That comes in later. All right, question number two.
Well, let me follow up on that one quick second. I did find a scripture somewhere that said right after they came out of the Exodus, they said that they were told that that would be the starting of their year. The first of Nisan would be the first month.
Yeah, the first month. Right. So in other words,
the crossover.
Right, right. So the biblical calendar, in terms of not what year we're in, but what month was considered. Right. So Nisan became the new year. Now, as Jewish tradition evolved over the years, over the centuries, a Jewish tradition said there are different new years. There's an agricultural new year. There's a civil new year. So ultimately, Jews around the world celebrate in the seventh month, the first day, as the new year, Rosh Hashanah, which in the Bible is the Feast of Trumpets. But if you want to argue biblically, then the new year would be around March, April, Nisan. Absolutely.
Okay, but anyway, this calendar, this particular calendar, starts with Rosh. But the other thing that I didn't understand was about the Jubilee years.
Yeah.
And you might have answered that pretty much, because they were all over the map. They were calling everything a Jubilee run, so I got really lost. But I finally decided I needed to ask you.
Yeah.
The last Jubilee year that you know of?
There is real debate about this, Frank. In other words, we know it's instituted in Leviticus 25. We know that God said in the 50th year on the Day of Atonement that you will have a jubilee. You sound the trumpet throughout the land, and there's a jubilee. So it's not just debts forgiven. That would happen every 7 years. But if you had sold your property, your ancestral property, because of debt, that now reverts back to you in the 50th year. If you had a slave who said, hey, I want to serve you for life. I love being in your home. I want to serve you for life. In the 50th year, that person would go free. If they'd only been there for 20 years, they would go free. So what happened is that traditional Jews at a certain point lost track of the exact dates. So there is debate about that. There are scholars who believe that when Jesus ministered, he started his ministry in a Jubilee year. And that's why he starts quoting in Luke 4, he starts quoting from Isaiah 61, which speaks of proclaiming Jubilee. This is like the end time Jubilee, the release of prisoners and things like that. but traditional Jews are not exactly sure. There is debate. So if I'm just looking now, okay, if I type in next Jubilee year, right, and if I go to a religious Jewish website like Chabad, Chabad.org, so they are traditional Jews. Of course, they do not believe Jesus is the Messiah. Here's what the article says. The Jubilee year is currently not observed or commemorated. The reasons for this are complex, etc. So even though it's in the Bible, traditional Jews don't observe a strict Jubilee year for a number of reasons. And one is the certainty of knowing when it is. So there are a good number of questions that come up about these things. Hey, Frank, thanks for finally calling in and listening on weekends. God bless you. All right, before I go to the phones, as a Jew, I'm going to address anti-Semitism, all right? Just like you may be a woman and live in a certain part of the world where women are treated a certain way, you can address that issue better than I can. Or maybe you grew up in the rural Black South and you were a second-class citizen, you can address that better than I can. But as a Jew, I can address anti-Semitism. And I have felt for decades, as a Jew, a special connection with Black believers. For whatever reason, maybe it was a certain kind of quality of soul that was there, maybe a shared history of suffering in different ways. Jews in America have not suffered as acutely, obviously. If you go back in our history, there are times when we didn't have the same rights and access that others. But Jews in America have a lot of prominence today. That's not been the norm in our history. So as nations have liberated slaves, a certain soul, I've always especially enjoyed a connection of, especially with Black believers. So it grieves me when I see what the enemy has done to sow seeds of discord between Blacks and Jews, to see Jewish presidents prejudice against Blacks and Black prejudice against Jews. And what many Jews are shocked to see now is kind of the influence of the Louis Farrakhans of the world, these blatant anti-Semites who have impacted a lot of the Black community. And here's a headline from this week. Larry Johnson, so famous retired NFL football player, Larry Johnson, former NFL running back, tweets, "Jews involved in cabal of evil. Ex-Kansas City chief accuses Jewish people of engaging in sex trafficking, pedophilia, ritualistic child torture, perversion, human sacrifice, and murder." I mean, the worst of the ugly libels and lies against the Jewish people. He made these accusations and was standing by them. There is something very insidious that the enemy is seeking to spread. And I want to encourage you to expose these lies. It's come up with some rappers. It's come up with some Black celebrities recently that they've really been influenced. Other athletes, they have really been influenced by this perverse anti-Semitism. A Farrakhan, I understand just in our YouTube chat now, there are other manifestations of anti-Semitism. Hey, can I just talk to those of you that right now have the ability to post in YouTube, so you're free enough to post in YouTube right now, and you don't call, you post anti-Semitic lies, you post anti-Israel lies, misinformation, blatant anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish racism, and you have the guts to call. I have zero respect for you. I have zero respect for you hiding behind anonymity on the internet, flooding our chat with garbage, lies, and hate speech, and you don't have the guts to call in where I will allow you to speak to our audience around the world and access everyone that we've built up over years and years and years of hard work, building up an audience and prayer, much prayer. I give you access to them, and you don't even have the guts to call? And if you're savvy enough to post on the internet, you can find a way to call wherever you are in the world. And I'm looking right now, and there's a phone line that's open. If you wanted to call, there's actually a phone line that's open. You could. So not only do you get blocked for spreading hate speech. Hey, look, if you were doing this against blacks right now, you'd be blocked just as quickly. If you were doing this against some other group, you'd be. If you were doing this against Arabs or Muslims, you'd be blocked just as quickly. Yeah, look at these quotes. No one likes Talmudian subversion. Every single day, more and more people know what you guys are doing. Friend, you are believing lies. The same kind of lies that fuel the fires of the Holocaust are the lies you are believing. And you are so cowardly, you won't even come on the air and share your views. Tell you what, you are hiding in darkness. If you had the truth, you'd come into the light and share it. I've invited anti-Semites on the air. I've reached out to different people. I said, let's have a private discussion. Let's have a public debate. Nope. Now, Dr. E. Michael Jones, who spreads a lot of anti-Semitic information, he immediately came on my show. I gave him the invitation. He immediately came on. He's subsequently offended by my referring to his views as anti-Semitic and feeling that we subsequently edited comments. Of course, we didn't edit his comments out. Of course not. But in any case, I said, well, let's have a public debate then, Dr. Jones. He's a scholar. Let's have a public debate. Are your views anti-Semitic or not? Let's have a public debate. Hasn't taken me up on this. And others, we've opened the door to Owen Benjamin and others. Hey, come on my show. You got a show. I'll come on yours. And let's look at facts. Facts. Texts. History. Why do people run from that? Why do they run from that? And all the centuries where the Jews were the tail and not the head, where the Jews were the outcasts and persecuted and hated because they didn't fit in, because they didn't convert to Catholicism or they didn't convert to Islam or whatever the prevailing religion was. And they were impoverished and they were slaughtered in pogroms and stuff. Oh, yeah. And they're somehow running the world? Yeah, right. How about this? Headline from August 3rd. Jewish community protests open anti-Semitism at Berlin coronavirus protest. Rally supported by neo-Nazi groups drew more than 20,000 protesters in the German capital to demand an end to virus restrictions. Where does anti-Semitism come in? Because the Jews are behind the virus. The Jews are the ones messing up the economy. It's just another plot for the Jews to take over the world. And it's that kind of ignorance, the kind of hatred, the kind of bias, the kind of bigotry that leads to all kinds of bloodshed. Hey, friends, I face the truth. I speak the truth. I'm in conflict with the Jewish community every day over Jesus and our particular views over Yeshua. So be it. And we Jews, we sin like everybody else, and we need redemption. But if you're going to lie and hide in the shadows, go back into the shadows.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on The Line of Fire. You might say, Dr. Brown, you got kind of strong with people. Hey, I know that anti-Semitism leads to bloodshed. I was warning before the synagogue shooting by John Ernest, a professing Christian. I was warning that the rhetoric that was going around was going to lead to bloodshed. And you read his manifesto, it sounds like it's right out of the talking points of some of the current junk that's out there. He alone is responsible for his actions. All right. He alone is responsible, as I said repeatedly. But I warn because I see where these things go. By the way, if Jews had all the money in the world, then we wouldn't be partners with you because it's your support that enables us to be on the air. So click on donate if you're watching on the Ask Dr. Brown Facebook channel. If you believe in what we're doing and say, hey, Dr. Brown, we're standing with you, click on donate. Those funds go right into more broadcasts, reaching more people. And if everyone does what they can, small, large, it'll be great. On the YouTube channel, right beneath the chat box is a dollar sign. You can click on that or go to our website, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate. Okay, real quick, before I go back to the phones, Israel has offered to help Lebanon even though Hezbollah has been based in Lebanon and has terrorized Israel for years, Israel has said, hey, we want to help Lebanon. We want to help Beirut after this absolutely mind-bogglingly devastating disaster with these terrible explosions that took place a couple of days ago. Terrible loss of life, terrible upheaval. They said between $10 and $15 billion in damage, something like 300,000 people homeless, over 5,000 injured, well over 100 dead, and God only knows what that number is going to become. So Sweden's former prime minister, Carl Bildt, who serves as the co-chair of the European Council on Foreign Relations, issued a tweet mocking this, mocking Israel's desire to help, saying, the only encouraging thing in this catastrophe in Lebanon is that even Israel has been quick in offering humanitarian aid. What kind of a snipe is that? Well, there's an article on Daily Wire by Hank Berrien, and it documents one thing after another, after another, after another, of what Israel has done in helping lead the way in suffering catastrophe. Here, just one example from 2018, October 2018, a Palestinian baby in a Tel Aviv hospital is fighting for his life. But the only reason the baby is still alive is that an Israeli family that lost their one-year-old child the week before agreed to donate the child's heart only hours before the Palestinian child became the recipient of a heart transplant performed by Israeli doctors. Israel has been at the front lines of helping. You know, with the civil war in Syria, doctors have gotten as close to the border as they can and put themselves in life-threatening situations to help sick that are smuggled out, brought out by stealth for treatment because they can't be treated in Syria. We're talking about Muslims. We're talking about people who've been hostile to Israel. Israel's there to help in many humanitarian ways. Those are facts. There's a whole article. Just don't have time to go through all of it. But, you know, after the truth, here, Israel sent relief to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. First response aid after the 2004 tsunami with 60 tons of international aid to Indonesia, 82 tons of relief to Sri Lanka. 2010, Israel's relief team of 200 people was the first to arrive to help the victims of the earthquake in Haiti from Israel. Israel's done this for years. Fact. Fact. All right, back to the phones. We go to Emra in Karimios. Is that it? British Columbia. Thanks so much for holding. How do you pronounce your city there?
It's Karimios. The short form will be Karem.
Okay, or Karem. Right, good biblical word.
Yeah.
There. Yes, so what's your question? And thanks for holding, Emra.
Yeah, my question is about the temple.
Yeah.
I know that the New World Order, the New World Religion wants the temple built fast as well. And my thing is that I don't believe that the Wailing Wall is part of the of God's temple. It's actually God's temple should be in the city of David, close to the Gihon Springs. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, there is debate about that, but it's really, Emra, in all candor, a tremendously minority opinion that overwhelmingly the information that we have puts the Temple Mount where it's understood to be. Now, the Kotel, the Western Wall, known to people outside of Israel as the Wailing Wall, was not actually part of the temple. That was an external wall in the larger temple complex. But when you go on a tour to Israel with us, one of the things the tour guide will say is we can be certain these steps that we're going up here leading up to what would have been the ancient temple are steps that Jesus and the apostles would have walked on. That I don't see any way for a third temple to be built without the Dome of the Rock being removed. If it could have been built in the City of David, there's a lot less restricting it. There are some that have argued for it. There are some who've made the argument, and to me, it's immaterial. In other words, I have no vested interest in arguing about geography. I'm not going to be physically involved in building a temple. But the best arguments I've seen, the best history, the degree of spiritual controversy over that, the artifacts that are still being discovered under the Temple Mount, which is strangely under control of Palestinian Authority, and they've regularly destroyed things to try to deny the ancientness of the heritage. That's another thing to look at. Why is it that the Muslim world tries to deny the presence there and tries to deny the history there? It's also because that's where it unfolded. So in my view, I don't see it. I don't believe that it was a part of the ancient city of David, which is, an entirely different location. You can go there. Some of our trips, we've actually had time to go over and look at the archaeological excavations there. But I do believe that it has to be where, in the proximity of where the Dome of the Rock is, that would have to be removed. How that would happen is one of the great mysteries. Okay, 866-34-TRUTH. Yeah, let me just give you a sample of some of what was being posted. Big Nose Spaz, Jews, Big Nose, of course, that's me. Beware the Tiny Hats. Stop mutilating babies. Allegedly, this is what Israel is doing. Whoa, Jew, oi, Jew, you're being anti-whitest, Dr. Brown. I mean, it's silly, idiotic comments. This is just a little sample of what was flooding our YouTube chat. That being said, hey, you want to learn, keep watching, keep listening. But you're going to be challenged with truth. What happens when the house of cards that you have built on anti-Semitic lies begins to crumble? What's going to happen then when the whole thing begins to fall apart because it is built on lies? Yeah, and you're repeating some of the Owen Benjamin stuff. He's really been polluted with this. I haven't followed his stuff in ages. But when I exposed some of the junk that he was putting out, some of the anti-Semitic junk that he was putting out, and expressed concern for his well-being, what's going on that he's believing these lies and spreading them, we actually had to dismantle comments on that YouTube video because they were so ugly, they were so vile, they were so despicable that we're just not going to give place to that, even though we welcome disagreement every day. All right, do I have time? Let's see. Okay, let's go to Roger in Hudgens, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Dr. Brown. It's great to be on your program.
Thank you.
You came to my church, many years ago during the Brownsville Revival and spent many days there, several days there ministering, and that was a great blessing to us. So it was a Bethel Temple in Hampton with Pastor Ron Johnson.
Yes, I remember. His youth pastor then took over a church, was skateboarder, took over a church in California, a very aggressive soul-winning guy. And then Ron Johnson moved down to the Orlando area, and I saw him there years earlier.
Right,
but yes, Ron was one of the ones that he came with a team of pastors visit the Brownsville Revival, and as they drove back, the Spirit fell in the car with intercession and groaning travail, and that Sunday he got up, preached repentance, and people bringing in porn from their cars and drugs and alcohol, and yeah, things broke open. I remember being there for a few days, absolutely.
It was amazing, yeah. It went on for months at our church.
I know.
But anyway, thank you for coming. Wanted to ask you a question about Jesus and the woman that was caught in adultery.
Yeah.
I realize that, the Pharisees that brought her did not bring the man, so they did not do it in accordance with the law. But we know that Jesus kept the whole law, and at that time it looks like he set a standard that if you're without, only those that are without sin could cast a stone. So my question is, going back into the Old Testament, how could anybody implement the Jewish law keep the things of the law when they had, obviously everybody committed sin?
Right. All right, so I got to jump in and answer really quick. It's a great question because we know that Yeshua sometimes differed with the traditions of his day, but he upheld the law of Moses. Okay, they did not have the legal authority to put someone to death at that time under the Romans. If it happened like Stephen being stoned to death, that was a mass crowd thing that happened. But they did not have the authority to actually carry out the death penalty. And again, they themselves were guilty of all types of gross hypocrisy. And Jesus, as God, does have the power to forgive. He can always extend mercy above the law. So in Old Testament times, yes, it was imperfect people carrying out these things and enforcing the death penalty, even though they themselves were not perfect. But here, Jesus is using this to go over and above the law with forgiveness so God can have mercy on whom he has mercy, right? That's biblical. He was exposing their hypocrisy, and they really didn't have legal authority under Rome even to carry it out. So all the more, he stood up and did what he did. Hey, something to further discussion, really.